Nikolai Lugansky with an electrifying account of Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto in D minor. The Royal Scottish National Orchestra and conductor Peter Ungern here at the BBC Proms. We heard Nikolai Lugansky earlier saying that it took him just 3.5 days to learn that concerto initially, but his reading of it has just got deeper and deeper. Playing such a well-known work is like a sunrise, he says. Every day it's the same, but every day the experience is different. Lugansky was talking to me earlier about his relationship with Rachmaninoff, and he said, for me, it's about love, and I can't explain why. But in my opinion, he's the greatest Russian composer. He has huge admiration for the man as well as the musician. Promeners here in the Royal Albert Hall clamoring with their feet, hands, voices. Here come Nikolai Lugansky and Peter Ungern for another bow. Talking earlier about how Rachmaninoff draws on his knowledge of Russian culture and in particular Orthodox chant for that concerto, particularly the chant of the 16th and 17th centuries. He said this became his melodical language, and I asked him if he felt that resonating in his blood, and he said of course, but at the same time he would never say that a Russian has a specific claim to Rachmaninoff. In fact, he made the point that some of the greatest interpreters have been Italian, Polish, Hungarian. He said the great thing about music is you don't need to study with books. It gets directly to your heart, your mind, your soul. If you're sensitive and open, it does not matter what nationality you are. This is why music is higher than literature, higher than poetry, because we don't need any special education to enjoy it. Well, speaking of enjoyment, the Promers here at the Royal Albert Hall going absolutely wild for Nikolai Lugansky tonight, the 41-year-old Muscovite who's got such acclaim for his interpretations of Rachmaninoff. He's bringing Peter Ungern back to the front of the stage for another bow. And up come the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. Rachmaninoff, of course, an extraordinarily virtuosic pianist in his own right. Interestingly, like our other Russian composer on tonight's programme, Tchaikovsky, despite all his success, Rachmaninoff had a lack of creative self-confidence. He always doubted the worth of his music, which he often revised with substantial cuts. No need to question his worth tonight. Well, if piano concertos are your thing, remember you can catch up on the iPlayer with Prom 23 from earlier this week. Paul Lewis playing Mozart's piano concerto number 25 in C, and there are all sorts of other Proms treasures to be seen and heard online. Now, after the interval, the final piece in tonight's Prom will be Tchaikovsky's Symphony number 5. Now hugely popular, it was described negatively in one early review as exhibiting all the untamed fury of the Cossack, wetting itself for deeds of atrocity. Tchaikovsky was part of a 19th century tradition of reviving Cossack mythology, a movement being reenacted on the streets of Russia today. In tonight's 20 minutes, Alexander Khan, cultural correspondent for the BBC's Russian service, reports on the rise of the Cossacks.
It is well known what an army raised on Russian soil for the Orthodox faith is like. There is no power stronger than faith. It is threatening and invincible like a rock, and rising amidst the stormy, ever-changing sea. From the very bottom of the sea, it rears to heaven its jagged sides of firm, impenetrable stone. It is visible from everywhere and looks the waves straight in the face as they roll past. And woe to the ship which is dashed against it. Its frame flies into splinters, everything in it is split and crushed, and the startled air re-echoes the piteous cries of the drowning.
The might and vigor of these voices, the voices of the Cossacks in contemporary Moscow, seemed to go hand in hand with the poetic beauty and reverential awe of Nikolai Gogol's text from his great Cossack novel Taras Bulba. Today, Cossacks might draw inspiration from their rich and powerful history and the colorful description of their heroic life in Russian literature, music, and painting. But there's an irony in the juxtaposition. Gogol's Cossack army was fighting for their independence and genuine Orthodox faith against the prevailing army of their neighbors and arch enemies, Catholic Poles. The Cossack army in the streets of Moscow is fighting young women from feminist art group Pussy Riot and their exhibition in the Moscow gallery.
Here we have Cossacks from Siberia, Orenburg, Andon, and Kuban. We have hundreds of thousands of Cossacks behind us. We have millions. We're here because there is a blasphemy against our sacred Orthodox faith.
This young man, Nikolai Dyakonov, calls himself Chief of Staff of the Don Cossack Army.
And remember, next time we won't just talk.
And here we are in Kuban, an area in southern Russia, neighboring with Chechnya, where Cossacks have always lived, and where now they again picket an art show, this time a modern interpretation of classic Russian icons. In the cultured St. Petersburg, Cossacks protested the exhibition of the Chapman brothers in the Hermitage and the staging of Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita in a local theater. Arkady Kramarev, the local ataman, as the Cossacks traditionally call their military leader, is obviously embarrassed and tries to play down the importance of the protest.
There were no pickets whatsoever. All there was a letter addressed to the media that protested some exhibitions or theater productions. The letter was signed "The Cossacks of St. Petersburg." But no matter how we tried, we could not find a single Cossack who had signed the letter. So I believe this was just a provocation.
The writer and chronicler of the Cossack history, Andrei Smirnov, is much more outspoken.
It's only good that there are people in Russia who protest against Satanism, against desecration of Orthodox faith and Orthodox values. If we are being fed with this pseudo-cultural filth and devilishness, thank God that Cossacks stepped out to protect the Cossack Orthodox faith. Russian people, led and organized by the Cossacks, should kick the ass of all this pervert Western influence. Thank God the Cossacks are there.
Even within the Cossack community, there are voices of condemnation towards Zhereznyi or geysers, a contemptuous moniker given to these loud-mouthed protesters, self-appointed Cossacks fully clad in conspicuous uniform, complete with epaulettes, tall sheepskin hats, and cavalry swords. The 1917 revolution destroyed the age-old Cossack way of life, with its deeply ingrained sense of community, self-reliance, and the three cornerstones of the pre-revolutionary Russia: orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationhood. Many fled the country. The remaining were dispossessed and exiled. And by the late 1930s, the Cossacks, as a separate and distinctive social group, had virtually ceased to exist. However, the myth and the charisma, deeply entrenched in the nation's collective memory and immortalized in the arts, prevailed. No wonder that as soon as the collapse of communism lifted the ideological pressure, the Cossacks started moving towards a long-dreamt-of revival. But the social foundation for the Cossack life has not been restored, nor have they been allowed to resume their traditional military function. Sadly, much ado about trivial causes overshadows the really important questions. Who are the Cossacks today? And on which ground can they revive their identity and their community? To answer these, we need to look back a few centuries to understand who the Cossacks are historically. Yana Howlett is a lecturer in Russian history at the University of Cambridge.
Some people argue that they are actually of Tatar origin. Some people say that they are descendants of the native population of Central Siberia. Some people have argued that they are a Circassian group, i.e. that they come from the Caucasus. But it comes to mean, certainly by the 15th century, people who are on Russia's southern and southwestern borders. It is quite clear that the early Cossack detachments were of several different ethnicities. It's only really in the 17th century that Cossacks come to be linked with descendants of Slavs, being Russian Orthodox, having served in several generations to the Russian crown. These troublesome southerners who expect to be rewarded with freedom from tax in return for military obligations in defending southern borders.
And defend borders they did. Cossack settlements, stanitsas, were stationed along the entire length of the borders of the huge Russian Empire. And the Cossacks pushed them outwards. In the late 16th century, the legendary Cossack Yamrak Timofeyevich was hired by the Ural merchants, the Stroganovs, to protect their land against the Tatars, but ended up conquering Siberia for the Tsar Ivan the Terrible. But the Cossacks were not always loyal servants of the Tsar. In the late 1600s, Stepan Razin and a century later Emelyan Pugachev, both Cossacks, led powerful peasant revolts. Both were captured and executed, which only enhanced their wide popular appeal and heroic standing among the liberal Russian intelligentsia. Переднем стенька Разин, обнявшись, сидит с княжной. The famous Russian folk song Stenka Razin, celebrating these actions, wasn't the only artistic response. In 1834, Pushkin wrote his History of Pugachev, and a year later, in his novel The Captain's Daughter, drew a very sympathetic portrait of the still officially treacherous Cossack rebel. It was in the wake of this growing popularity and romantic mythologization of the Cossacks that Gogol wrote his novel, Taras Bulba.
An army of 120,000 Cossacks appeared on the frontier of the Ukraine. This was no small detachment sallying forth for plunder or in pursuit of the Tatars. No, the whole nation had risen, for the measure of the people's patience was over full. They had risen to avenge the disregard of their rights, the dishonourable humiliation of themselves, the insults to the faith of their fathers and their sacred customs, the outrages upon their church, the excesses of the foreign nobles, the disgraceful domination of the Jews on Christian soil, and all that had aroused and deepened the stern hatred of the Cossacks for a long time past.
In the 19th century, you have two very different visions of what the Cossacks represent.
Yana Howlett again.
One of them is they represent some kind of purity of Slav belief in ethnos and religion. So you will do anything, even sacrifice your own life, in order to safeguard your national traditions and your religious traditions. It also represents the Cossacks as being the sort of bulwark against Poland, the Ottoman Empire, so against Islam, against Judaism, really Catholicism being the strongest enemy at this stage.
Taras made raids all over Poland with his band, burned 18 towns and nearly 40 churches, and reached Krakow. Spare nothing was the order of Taras, and raising the children in the streets upon the points of their lances, they cast them also into the flames.
So he represents the attitude which kind of characterizes the first half of the 19th century, where the idea of Cossacks is being revived, where the Cossacks are being represented as traditional defenders of Russia, which is probably why in 1827 the crown prince of the Russian Empire becomes automatically the hetman of all the Cossacks. When Gogol writes about them, he represents them precisely that way.
In 1863, the Cossacks find themselves in the center of another novel, Leo Tolstoy's eponymous The Cossacks. This time, we're not in Ukraine. We're in the area which most of the contemporary Cossacks consider their main territory, borderline stanitsas in southern Russia, next to the Caucasian hillsmen who, in the time of Tolstoy, as much as now, presented the main threat to the integrity of the Russian state.
A tradition still fresh among them declares that Tsar Ivan the Terrible came to the Tiarik, sent for their elders, and gave them the land on this side of the river, exhorting them to remain friendly to Russia and promising not to enforce his rule upon them nor oblige them to change their faith. Even now, the Cossack families claim relationship with the Chechens, and the love of freedom, of leisure, of plunder, and of war still form their chief characteristics.
In Tolstoy's story, a young officer leaves the comfortable idleness of Moscow and, to the utter surprise of his comrades, volunteers to serve in the Caucasus. Amongst the Russian Orthodox Cossacks there, he finds a way of life which in its moral integrity, simplicity, and genuineness is much closer to the Chechens across the border than to the high society in the capital. Yana Howlett again.
To him, the Cossacks represent the earlier Cossack period, like the Razins and the Pugachevs, the people who organized the uprisings, who are seen as having freedoms, which they will defend against anybody. And even though they work for the Russians, they also maintain their own sense of self, which is what they are then teaching sort of the more spoilt central Russians. So, you know, they're the free, the beautiful, not too much thought and more action kind of person.
Only the harmful side of Russian influence shows itself by interference at elections, by confiscation of church bells, and by the troops who are quartered in the country or march through it. A Cossack is inclined to hate less the Jigit hillsman who maybe has killed his brother than the soldier quartered on him to defend his village but who has defiled his hut with tobacco smoke.
The Cossacks in Tolstoy's idyllic and pastoral description seem to have very little in common with the militant, bellicose spirit of Taras Bulba and his comrades. But even today, the kinship between the two branches of the Cossacks is blatantly obvious in language, in manners, in the way of life, which, I suggested to Yana Howlett, should be quite a bit of an issue in current, often strained Russo-Ukrainian relations.
Absolutely. I mean, that is why, at the moment, the whole question of what is a Cossack is highly politicized, because it also reflects what is the Ukraine versus Russia. In one vision, which is a very 19th century nationalist vision, Ukraine is the cradle of the Russian civilization. In another vision, Ukraine is a totally separate entity, defending itself both against its Western neighbors and then against Russia in the East, each of them wanting to oppress their freedoms and try to take over their culture and claim it for itself. And actually, Gogol is a very good example of precisely that. To many Ukrainians, he is a Ukrainian writer, even though he writes in Russian. Whereas to the Russians, at least, you know, to people of my generation, Gogol was represented as one of the great founders of Russian realism. Nothing to do with Ukraine at all. It's a dichotomy which continues to be problematic.
Even more problematic, given that Gogol himself was a Cossack, a descendant of the leader of the Zaporozhian Cossacks. Gogol's tales inspired one of the most renowned representations in painting of the Cossack tradition, the artist Ilya Repin's reply of the Zaporozhian Cossacks to the Sultan Mehmed IV of the Ottoman Empire. This historic, or possibly mythical, episode concerns the writing of a letter, a mocking reply to the Sultan's demands that the Cossacks submit to Turkish rule. It took the artist more than 10 years to paint, and Tsar Alexander III bought it for 35,000 rubles, at the time the greatest sum ever paid for a Russian painting. The huge canvas occupies an entire wall in the biggest hall of the State Russian Museum in St. Petersburg, and is rightly honored as one of the great masterpieces of Russian art. That's how Yana Howlett describes this historic canvas.
We have this kind of contrast between the scribe, who is an intellectual, quite clearly. It's kind of small and smiley and looking slightly bewildered, and surrounded by these Cossacks who are handsome, huge men. They're all kind of looking wild and happy as they point and laugh and just articulate rudely to show their attitude towards the possibility of vassaldom. The painting is interesting because, like so many Riepin paintings, it's both a historical narrative, or purports to be a historical narrative, and a piece of realism, but actually it's a series of body studies, very carefully posed around the table, aren't they? Especially in the foreground, this Cossack half-naked, sort of leaning over the table, with the Cossack to the right in his great hat, holding his belly. And sort of they all represent the kind of animal joy of being a Cossack, anti-intellectual, active, and able to fight with both bare hands and with arms at the drop of a hat.
So what of 19th century music? Where does Tchaikovsky fit in with this? For all his sensitivity and his homosexuality, he celebrated his Cossack side in many works, his opera Mazeppa, his Cossack dances, and in the wild, driving gestures of his symphonies.
The Tchaikovskys see themselves as descended on one side from a Ukrainian Cossack headman called Chaika. So he may well have been kind of turning back to his roots when writing certainly some of his later work. It's a difficult one because this turning to a perceived past is not something that's specific only to Russian music of the 19th century. You find it in Czech music, French music, in Wagner, I was going to say in German music. It's hard to know to what extent the kind of the search for an authentically national music, not just in the story you tell, as in Mazeppa, but also in where you get your melodic lines and so on, whether that is specifically something that Tchaikovsky is doing or whether he's working within a much broader tradition in which the sense of being national is defined as being national both in content but also in form. And the search for a national form is a really problematic thing to be doing. That is why I'm slightly hesitant about saying it's a simple thing of turning to your past.
Turning to the past is what drives a lot of the current Cossack revival. A revival which also reflects the controversial history of the Cossacks in the 20th century, when Soviet propaganda cynically used their tradition and imagery. Quiet Flows the Don, a powerful novel about Cossacks in the Civil War, won Soviet writer Mikhail Sholokhov the Nobel Prize in Literature, even though his authorship of the book is still being contested. The 1949 film, Cossacks of Kuban, made at a time of post-war famine and starvation, depicted prosperous and happy Cossack life in the style of a Hollywood musical. It has since become a symbol of unashamedly Orwellian Stalinist propaganda. I leave the last word to Boris Almazov, prominent writer and historian. He's proud of his Cossack ancestry, bitterly wary of the prospects of Cossack revival, and vehemently critical of the current Cossack exploitation.
It's become a kind of a national cowboys and Indians game. But what are the Indians supposed to make of it? The Cossacks are howling with pain. The Don, Kuban, and other indigenous Cossack territories are bursting with problems. The Caucasus is flooded with the avalanche from the mountains that threatens to drown the Cossacks in their land. In the Don, they found copper and nickel deposits that, if mined, threaten to pollute the most fertile soil of the region. The other problem is the amateurish revival. It turns out to be quite gainful to claim Cossack ancestry. You are a nobody, a bum, but sew a braid onto your underpants and you're a Cossack. Buy yourself an aluminium cross and you're a general. The state, I have a feeling, does not have a clue what to do with all this. And another reason why I'm appalled with this tacky and phony revival is that what is popularized is only the lower village culture. And the Cossacks were different. Gogol and Repin were Cossacks. The great philosopher Alexei Losev was a Cossack. The founder of Russian cinema Ilya Khanzhonkov was a Cossack. These and many other Cossacks were a significant part of Russian culture. Contemporary Cossack culture is first and foremost in preserving the gems of the original culture that we have inherited from our ancestors. There are Cossack polyphonic choirs, which is a great vocal tradition. Being a Cossack means feeling this pain inside rather than flashing it out. It's a grief within you, and it is repulsion with what you see around. I am a Cossack. and I have this pain.
Words of Boris Almazov there. The Rise of the Cossacks was presented by Alexander Kahn and produced by Melvin Rickaby. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and thanks for being with us here on BBC Radio 3, the home of the proms. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill. To close tonight's prom from the Royal Scottish National Orchestra with their new music director Peter Ungern, we're going to hear Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony as part of a complete Tchaikovsky symphony cycle taking place at this year's proms. In his notebook, the composer indicated the recurring opening motto represented complete resignation before fate, a theme he also visited in operas such as Eugene Onegin and The Queen of Spades. Well, Peter Ungern is making his proms debut tonight. His rather idiosyncratic route to the conductor's podium includes almost playing for Chelsea FC, at least in his dreams, and very definitely leading the Tokyo Quartet for no less than 14 years. Earlier, I asked him how his prominent chamber career had informed his approach today.
I mean, obviously there are huge differences between the act of conducting and the act of playing first violin in the quartet, but the mental approach to the music making and the way you listen and the way you feel about the music, there is a lot of influence from doing all those Beethoven and Bartok cycles and so on.
Audiences might be surprised, though, that you would approach a huge epic work like Tchaikovsky's Fifth from a chamber perspective.
It's wildly dramatic in many respects, but it's also beautifully intimate and introspective in many places and full of the kind of agony that seems to be almost unique to the Russian soul. That's kind of agony of darkness that we have that also in the Rachmaninoff piano concerto tonight. Sometimes it just tears through you, the anguish that these composers can express.
This is your first full season with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. How's it going so far?
Wonderful. There's a wonderful group of people, lovely musicians, eager to work. It's very, very engaged music making. They play everything, you know, the way I love it, which is like chamber music. I mean, they listen to each other and they relate each of their lines one to the other. So I'm enjoying it tremendously.
Well, he is about to make his way back to the Royal Albert Hall stage. He certainly seems to have been enjoying himself tonight. Here he is, Peter Ungern, to conduct the Royal Scottish National Orchestra in Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony in E minor.
Thank you.
Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony in E minor, part of a complete Tchaikovsky symphony cycle at the Proms this season, performed by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra and music director Peter Ungian, who's just coming to the end of his first season with the orchestra and conducting Tchaikovsky without a score tonight at his Proms debut. Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony, Peter Ungian says, "I love its dramatic sweep and sincerity. It's a study of the conflicts of human experience, dread, fear, and a longing for beauty and triumph. Extraordinarily conceived," he says, "as a work." Well, it's an absolutely triumphant introduction to the Proms for him and a spirited return for his new orchestra, the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. That's the principal horn player, David McClenahan, getting a rousing cheer here. Which brings tonight's Proms to a close. Thanks for joining me, Clemency Burton-Hill. I'll be back to the Proms Saturday matinee from Cadogan Hall tomorrow afternoon, when we have music by Britten, Tippett, Lennox Berkeley and Gustav Holst. Sean Edwards conducts mezzo Sarah Connolly and the Britten Sinfonia. We're live here on Radio 3, the home of the Proms, from 3 p.m. Meanwhile, it's back over to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Clemency, thank you very much indeed. Clemency Burton-Hill with tonight's Prom live at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's a second chance to hear that Prom on Sunday afternoon here on Radio 3 when we have the next in our series of Proms repeat programmes at 2 o'clock. Tomorrow there's lots at the Proms. There's a second chance to hear the pianist Imogen Cooper, the guitarist Christopher Denoth and singers Ruby Hughes and James Gilchrist when they teamed up at the BBC Proms Chamber Music Series at Cadogan Hall last Monday. The concert was broadcast live here on Radio 3. It was a programme of songs by Benjamin Britten, and you can hear it at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And as Clemency said, more Britten after that when we're live at Cadogan Hall with music by him and his peers. That's at 3. And we're back at the Royal Albert Hall at 7:30 tomorrow evening to hear the violinist Vadim Repin playing James McMillan's Violin Concerto. He was the man who premiered the piece back in 2010. Also on the bill tomorrow, Johann Strauss and Beethoven, his overture Coriolan, and to end, the Fifth Symphony, all played by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra under their chief conductor, Donald Runicles. We'll be there for that concert live here on the home of the BBC Proms, Radio 3, at 7:30 tomorrow night.
BBC Radio 3 at Proms Plus. Free events across the 2013 Proms season, capturing the musical, literary and artistic background to some of the featured music and themes. Go to the Radio 3 website or the BBC iPlayer radio app to hear some of the Proms Plus events so far, including author John le Carré celebrating 50 years since the publication of The Spy Who Came In from the Cold.
We all of us instinctively incline towards the conspiratorial moment and, quite simply, the patriotic moment.
BBC Proms Plus. Go online to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Well, back to tonight, we'll be reflecting on another festival that lit up the night last weekend in Wiltshire, the WOMAD Festival of World Music. World on 3 brings you highlights of the festival at 9:45 tonight. But let's stay with the BBC Proms a while longer and reflect on the first piece that you might have heard in tonight's concert and on much more besides. It's time for a Proms composer portrait, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music and presented by Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to the first Proms composer portrait of the season. I'm delighted to be joined on stage by Naresh Sohal, composer of the new piece in this evening's Prom, The Cosmic Dance. And we're going to be finding out more about Naresh Sohal's music with the help of young musicians from the Royal College of Music. We'll be meeting them in a few minutes' time. Now, Naresh, a bit of background, first of all, because you were born and brought up in the Punjab in pre-independence India. So I'm guessing that Western classical music wasn't part of your upbringing.
No, not at all. Western music is not part of the tradition in northern India at all. If anywhere there is Western music in India, it is Calcutta, Mumbai, and a little bit of Chennai or Madras, as it used to be called. There were amateur orchestras here and there. I think in Mumbai there was Zubin Mehta's father who had, Meli Mehta, who had an orchestra. But I was in the backwoods of Punjab where Western music had never been around.
But I believe you did hear rock and roll and you played a Western musical instrument.
Oh, that I could hear from radio.
Yeah.
Rock and roll and also Indian movie music, which is a thriving industry. And
so Bollywood was a Bollywood big thing at
music.
Home, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
And you played the harmonica.
I played the harmonica, and that's how I learned music. I played it just because after my matriculation, I had spare time, and my friends were playing one or two harmonicas, so I picked up the harmonica. I could play it. I had a chromatic harmonica. I could play reasonably well in those days. And as there were festivals all around in college days, youth festivals and all that, I used to participate in those and play the harmonica. And one day I wanted to learn classical Indian music. So I asked the teacher who used to be appended to us, who played the violin, and I asked that I would like to learn Indian music. And he was very derisory about that. And I didn't like it. And I told him that he was responsible for the slavery of India for the last 1,000 years because he was not prepared to impart education to others than his own family.
But at this time, you already knew that you wanted to find some place for yourself in music, but you hadn't yet discovered Western classical music at all.
Not at all. It is then that I taught myself notation with the help of harmonica and primers. And then I taught myself harmony, counterpoint. I was a physics and mathematics student, so harmony seemed a little bit manageable with physics. And then I discovered that there was a military band nearby. And I used to go there and write marches and waltzes for them, and they would kindly play it back to me. So I learned by trading, a practice of trade. And as you know, in a military band, no instrument plays in a straight key at all. Everybody's B flat or E flat or some flat, you know. So I had to learn transpositions and everything.
It's a very good discipline, isn't it?
It's a very good discipline.
Wonderful. So when did the classical music hit you? Because you were studying, as you said, mathematics and physics at university. What happened? What did you hear?
What happened was that I and a friend of mine who played the guitar with me, he suggested to me, why don't we go to Mumbai, Bollywood, as you are calling it, and that we should become music directors there. It is during that Mumbai time that I actually, on an August day, had heard Eroica Symphony. That was the first time I'd actually heard a piece of classical Western music. So I listened to the second movement of it, and I said, oh, I could play that on harmonica. That seems manageable. And so this sort of brought me. And when I came home,